sitting at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Perfection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
expression, expression,
expression,
participation, democracy, welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
reason,
leisure,
health,
education,
focus,
culture,
human rights,
Sergeant Dana,
solving,
guiding,
fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by R.E.M. and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm joined by co-host Gord Barnes. Welcome, Gord.
Well, thank you, Jim.
That might be a little bit of a surprise to some of our regular listeners. Mona's not here, but she's convalescing at the moment.
And I sure hope Mona's feeling better. I know it's been a tough 3 weeks, I guess, altogether now. And everybody who's listening in, I'm sure, is wishing you well, because I suspect Mona is listening into the show today.
Oh, I think so. I think so. And, no, she's doing very well, if anybody's wondering. She did spend a week in hospital, and her problems have been turned around, and she's, well, I think she was even back to work for a few hours this week, so,
on the mend, which is good news.
Yes. Anyway, we decided this week that we would have a look at some refugee issues, and one thing that's sort of related is, what is the 60th anniversary? Gord, help me out here.
Right.
of the plane wreck at Los Gatos Canyon in Mexico, I believe. Mm-hmm. And there were 32 people killed. Four of them were Americans. They were the crew of the airplane. It was a DC-3. And they were bringing back 28 Mexican migrant workers who had been expelled, basically, from the States. I think the people who had hired them to work in the first place had failed to take them back to Mexico, and the United States government was doing it. They were flying them back, and there was a mechanical problem with the airplane, and it crashed and killed, as I say, 32 people. And in the news reports about the crash, they only mentioned the names of the four Americans who were killed, and the other 28 people were referred to in the news reports as the deportees, I believe. And Woody Guthrie saw that those news reports, and he was so upset at the fact that the other victims of this crash were not even mentioned by name, that he wrote a poem. And the poem was performed to sort of a rough musical accompaniment. But after that, I'm not sure who it was that put it to music, and it's become a very famous protest song. And I just happen to have a version that Joan Baez sings, so I thought we would play that. And did you want to add anything before we play the music, Gord?
Oh, this is a really good choice. I think I listened to it last night, Jim, and Joan Baez does it very well. And I think it was 1948 that the plane crash happened. So, and it was actually on January 28th in 1948, so it's kind of a timely occasion to reflect on this.
Okay, well, here is Joan Baez.
Jesús, María, you won't. liberty. Is this the best way we can grow our good orchards? Is this the best way we can grow our good fruit? To fall like dry leaves and rot on your topsoil.
There, we're back on. It helps when I turn the mic on, Gordon.
That's great. It's an amazing piece of music, isn't it?
It is. I love Joan Baez.
Yeah. And, you know, Woody Guthrie was such an amazing artist, too. He really did come up with so many great folk songs that are just classics. I guess he and Pete Seeger, there'd be a few others that were part of that same vintage that... really are quite memorable.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that they're kind of set apart from everybody else when it comes to protest songs, and it's interesting. We sort of gloss over the fact that when they were in their prime and writing them songs and singing songs and going around, their records weren't played on the radio. You know, the governments of the day considered them radicals and dangerous and all that, and I suppose we're not much different here because people keep finding out that they've been under surveillance, you know, by government. Tommy Douglas was a good example, and Bob Ray just found out that he was under surveillance as well when he was in university. So it's a sort of a them and us kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, it's unfortunate with respect to people like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, because now when we hear the music these days, many of us will have forgotten the context in which the music was initially written. And that's why I really like to go back and reflect on that one piece of music that we just listened to now.
Mm-hmm.
That the idea that people were being removed from the United States, you know, the time that they were there to work in the fields had expired. The contractor that was supposed to return them to Mexico had not lived up to his obligations, so the American government was going to deport them back to Mexico. And then the plane crash happens, and terrible loss of life. And what, as you said earlier, what really inspired Woody Guthrie was the idea that the people who died in that plane crash, who were Mexicans, in all the news reports, were nameless. And I think that's one of the ways to kind of segue into our discussion today, really, about refugee issues, particularly as they relate to Canada. But I, you know, before doing that, I just comment that, you know, the whole piece around people who are Mexicans or maybe from other parts of Central America is still very, very current. As you know, thousands of people will travel through Mexico from other Central American countries, and even Mexicans in many cases will try to get into the United States, in some cases do. The journey through Mexico is incredibly unsafe, and Amnesty International and other organizations have documented how insecure people's lives are at that point. They're often traveling on the top of rail cars, stopped, and there have been reports of large numbers of people being killed and are taken advantage of during that process. The people who do successfully make it across the border often will work in unregulated factories in the United States and be exploited for their labor. And then at some point, if somebody decides that the time is appropriate, I guess they're returned again to Mexico or somewhere else and to very difficult circumstances. And, you know, I think it's a commentary on the continuing economic inequalities that exist within our world, that this happens even in today's context, never mind in 1948 when people were traveling from Mexico into the United States to work in the fields. So I thought, as I said earlier, that it would be an interesting piece to reflect on before we get into a discussion about refugee issues and some of Amnesty International's concerns in the Canadian context. Because, you know, when we talk about this many times, we do so without giving names to people or really reflecting on the circumstances in which they've left the country they've fled from. And I think I've mentioned previously on a show when, you know, you talk about refugee issues, it's kind of important to put it in context about how people might arrive in Canada as a refugee. So maybe we could do that first, Jim, if that's all right.
Sure.
One of the things that is worth being aware of is that people do come, you know, as accepted refugees, what is called convention refugees, and even at times many numbers of people will come assisted by the Government of Canada. They will have been in perhaps a refugee camp somewhere. Maybe they've had to flee conflict on their own country and traveled, say, from Kenya into another country, or from Cambodia into another country, or Burma into an adjacent one, been into a situation where they've been in a camp for many years. And quite appropriately, governments around the world will arrange to interview folks and determine whether they are willing to assist them as refugees to come to their country. And Canada does do that. And they'll settle across Canada, people who have come here. They don't typically get any choice in terms of where in Canada they go. It's just an interview that takes place in some very difficult circumstances where people have not had good shelter or good food or water, where young kids have not had access to education, and families have had tough times. So they'll get interviewed, and the Government of Canada will say, okay, we'll agree to have you come here as a refugee. The cost, actually, of them getting here is something they have to pay back in terms of travel costs. They'll arrive here and, as to say, be sent to a city or community across Canada, and it's not one where there's any choice involved. Many people do arrive and say, come to Regina, and they're assisted in those contexts by wonderful people who are volunteers, the Regina Open Door Society and other communities, organizations, the Regina Faith Community. Many of the church groups will help people in many ways. They'll get help some cases with language training and maybe some initial job search skills. Some of the other processes to help people arrive in Canada. And you know, it's fabulous when you think about the number of people in our own community here and across Canada that are so supportive of people who do come through that process, who volunteer their time every week as maybe a volunteer language tutor. That's just fabulous when you think about the generosity of people and the willingness of people to help in our community or other communities across the country.
Well, I'm just wondering, Gord, how is Bill C-4 going to affect the ability of refugees to come to Canada now?
Well, that's the other issue, is that, you know, that doesn't particularly impact on the refugees who are, I've just described. Bill C-4 is a current proposal that's before Parliament in Canada, proposed by the government, and it really impacts on people who are arriving in Canada in a different way. And that is the people who have come to Canada to our border in a different circumstance, in a boat, and large-scale boats, where they've come typically in the last number of years. It's been a number of situations where people who are Tamils who have fled the terrible conflict in Sri Lanka have arrived at our west coast. And, you know, they the conditions on the boats, by the way, have been awful. And women and children have been in terrible, terrible conditions, all the people on the boat. And, you know, they've arrived in usually the west coast, but not always, sometimes on the east coast. And more recently, the government of Canada has said that they're, through this piece of legislation, going to impose significant penalties on people, not only the people who operate the boats, who they're describing as smugglers, but also they're going to impose a penalty on the people who arrive, who are, you know, fleeing terrible circumstances and conflict in their home country and seek to come here as refugees. Amnesty International is not actually saying that we're opposed to dealing with human smugglers. Human smuggling is actually a very serious issue and a different one. It puts people at risk and all the rest. The issue is, what happens to the people who do arrive, oftentimes under terrible circumstances, hungry, at our border one way or another, and claim to be refugees? Well, this bill actually, or proposed legislation, would provide for the automatic detention of these people, men, women, and children, for a minimum period of a year with no right of appeal. And Amnesty International is very, very concerned about this. Other human rights organizations, including the Canadian Council of Refugees, have expressed concerns to members of Parliament. So we're involved in a effort to make people aware that this is a significant issue for the Canadian public to think about before the legislation is passed. You know, it hasn't always been the case that people have viewed, or some people in government at least, have viewed the idea of people arriving at our border in a boat as being and claiming to be refugees as being a problem. I can share a little story where at an earlier time, and this is actually, you know, not all that long ago in this context, Tamils arrived on our east coast. And it was August 12th, 1986, where off the coast of Newfoundland, there were 155 Tamils who arrived. And they were, if you can imagine, in two lifeboats drifting at sea in the North Atlantic. Just imagine that, men, women, and children in the terrible circumstances of the North Atlantic drifting at sea for over 5 days. And you know what happened? This amazing individual, and his name really does need to be recognized. His name was Gus Dalton. Gus Dalton was the fisherman from Newfoundland. He was the captain of the boat that came across these two lifeboats full of Tamils. in 1986. And, you know, he gave up, he and his crew actually gave up that day's fishing and rescued the Tamils. And that was no, you know, the loss of that day's fishing was no insignificant piece itself. But what would you do if you, any of us do, if you found people in that circumstance? Well, he made a decision to rescue them, to help them get back to, or get them to shore. Of course, in 1986, there was a debate in the Canadian public about, you know, what should happen to them. Some people said, you know, they should be returned. Of course, in 86, if they had been returned to Sri Lanka during that conflict, it would have been a terrible decision. To its credit, and to the credit of the Prime Minister of the day, and that was, by the way, Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, the Tamils were interviewed. There was discussions about, you know, why they were seeking refuge in Canada. They were permitted to stay, and to his credit, the then Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, publicly encouraged Canadians, and there's a lot on the record about this in terms of his role regarding the support he provided in terms of leadership, if I can put it that way, on this issue. He said, you know, we need to recognize at times people will come to Canada this way and welcome them to our shores. And that's a bit of a contrast to what's going on now with this Bill C-4.
Well, Gord, I know we've got a lot to talk about here. We've got just about time for a break. And I've been just wandering around the Internet here, and I've found some comments by the various artists who have covered Bob Dylan's songs for his new album that you can buy in support of Amnesty. And I think we'll play that after the break.
Okay? That's great.
Okay. So we'll just do our break here right now, and we will be right back.
It took me a few days to kind of make it become my own in a way where I can, oh yeah, feel the song. And so once that happened, you know, I was good to go, you know, I was good to do it. And we just recorded it, kept it simple. I wasn't trying to recreate Bob Dylan's original, but paying respect to it and honoring him and what he stands for and what Amnesty International stands for.
I don't get nervous for much, and one thing I've always been blessed with is a tremendous sense of false confidence. So when it came time to tackling Dylan, I'm like, sure, man, I'll rock that. I knew I wanted to do a radical reinterpretation of the song, and given my rich baritone voice, that was a given. The original, I did the song Blind Willie McTell, which is one of my favorite Bob Dylan songs, and the original is a haunting piano and acoustic guitar ballad. My version sounds more like Massive Attack meets Leonard Cohen.
What can I say about Bob Dylan that hasn't been said before? He sets the standard, and the standard is really high.
It's astounding to see so many artists coming together and supporting the cause of human rights, bringing their craft, their art, their skill, all for free, all as a donation to the cause.
It's thin ice covering a song as an artist as iconic as Bob Dylan's. His, not only are his songs brilliant, but his performances of his own songs are become iconic themselves.
And if you go to the Amnesty Canada website, you can find a link at which you can buy this album, Bob Dylan covers, for, I think it's about $20. And you'll notice, like they were saying on this little clip, that the artists themselves donated their time and their efforts. So it's a wonderful way to get some great Dylan songs and support Amnesty International.
Chimes of Freedom, it's called. It's a great way to support Amnesty International, and on my list, I'll be doing that real soon.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, onward here on our topic, and we're basically talking about Canada's policy towards refugees, and basically what we're talking about is refugees that get here from it's a desperate situation that they're escaping. They're not immigrants. That's what we want to contrast. They're not just immigrants who have decided that they want to come to Canada to find a better life. Mm. They are trying to avoid a situation in which their lives are in danger, and they have some opportunities here. But the main thing is that they're in danger in their own country, and so to get away from that, they have ended up on Canada's shores, and our government is presently, I think, taking a kind of a punitive attitude towards them when they arrive here.
That's right. The idea that people would arrive and seek to be refugees, and as I said earlier, this legislation that's being proposed would actually provide for an automatic detention without appeal of a year. It doesn't seem to be appropriate in so many contexts, and actually I think flies in the face of internationally accepted human rights standards. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 14, does provide for the right of asylum and for people to be able to, who are fleeing conflict, to be able to claim refugee status in another country. There are other international covenants, including, one in 1951 that specifically deals with refugee rights. It was, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was 1948, and since then there have been a number of international covenants on human rights issues that have provided more direction and support to international standards. Canada has signed on to these agreements. The one with respect to refugees, Canada has supported that. It's called the Convention and Protocol Relating to the Status of Refugees. And, I my own member of parliament, I wrote to him and expressed concern. That was Ralph Goodale. He responded to me, and his letter actually suggested that the proposed legislation, this Bill C-4, as it's currently described, actually may not be legal, and because it runs in conflict to the previously accepted and agreed to conventions around the rights of refugees. In that regard, it's just worth sort of sharing what the definition is around a refugee, and this was agreed to in 1951 by countries around the world, and that is, in the post Second World War context, the definition was a refugee is a person who has a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race or religion or nationality, or perhaps a membership in a particular social group or political opinion, or who is outside of the country of his nationality, or is unable, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country, or who, not having a nationality or being outside of the country of his former habitual residence, as a result of such events, is unable or owing such to such fear, is willing to return to it. So they're very specific definition, and just to clarify something else, it's really interesting in that context. In 1951, and it applies today too, and it's worth sharing as well. Even back in 1951, when they wrote the definition around refugees, it specifically said then later on in the convention that if a person has you know, been involved in committing war crimes or crimes against humanity, then they would not be regarded and could not avail themselves of the protection that people who are seeking refugee status would be provided. So the idea now that perhaps people are coming here and have been involved in some kind of atrocity, that's covered off relative to the conventions and the refugee definition. We can still go through the process of welcoming people, you know, as I said earlier, in interviews in refugee camp. We can welcome them at our borders if they arrive at our borders, and we should. We should undertake individual interviews with people to see the circumstances and obviously gather information to confirm that, you know, they are legitimate refugees. That's appropriate. But to turn around and say through a piece of legislation like Bill C-4 does that it's appropriate to detain people without any right of appeal for a year raises all kinds of concerns. And as I say, these concerns aren't simply being raised by, you know, Amnesty International. They're also being raised by the Canadian Council of Refugees. Interestingly enough, I saw the other day an open letter that was sent by a number of organizations in Australia who have experience with dealing with similar issues with their government. And this open letter to the Government of Canada expresses similar kinds of concerns where, you know, the detention of people for over a year without any right of appeal is entirely inappropriate. And as I said in the first half of the show, you know, I think we had a Prime Minister back in 1986, Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, who took a different approach, who encouraged Canadians, you know, to say we need to respect people's rights, welcome people who arrive at our borders under those circumstances. Unfortunately, it hasn't always been the case that we've done that. At an earlier stage in our history, when Jewish people were fleeing Nazi Germany, prior to and during the Second World War, you know, large numbers of Jewish people fled that country and sought protection in other countries. The government of Canada, unfortunately, at that point in our history, was not very welcoming of Jewish people. And, you know, there was an official within the Canadian government who had incredible influence during that period. And his attitude was none was too many, which there's actually been a book written to that effect. You know, that's the title of it. I'd recommend people take a look at that if you get a chance. But, you know, the story then was back, and it's a very tragic part of Canadian history and one where there's incredible regret around, is that people who were Jewish actually arrived, you know, from Europe in a boat or and were returned. They weren't admitted. When they arrived at our border, they were returned, and many of them, when they returned to Europe, unfortunately lost their lives. You know, that's a terrible bit of Canadian history that we need to reflect on as we think about a piece of legislation like this currently that's before the Parliament. You know, I think that Canadians are a generous people, generally speaking, and regardless of, you know, where we've come from or where we've been, want to uphold and support international human rights standards. And I'd encourage people to maybe take a little bit of time and learn more about these issues. There's lots of information on the Amnesty International website, and you're more than welcome to contact us if you've got questions or would like to get involved in this piece of Amnesty International's work.
Yeah, I was just looking at the webpage here with regard to that None Is Too Many piece that you were talking about, and it's astonishing the blatant actions against the immigration of Jews that were taken, and the director of immigration, the immigration branch, it's a branch of Department of Mines and Resources at that time in 1935. His name was Frederick Charles Blair, and he absolutely believed that people should be kept out of Canada instead of being allowed in. I wonder, I hope we're not headed back in that direction. I suppose we're not, but we're the reasons that people are being allowed back into Canada now, I think, are being narrowed far too much. I think we're looking at the profit. You know, we're getting people into Canada now that it's advantageous for Canada to have these people, but just to go in a slightly different direction here, not so advantageous for some of the countries that that these people are coming from. However,
or at least for the individuals who are, you know, fleeing really difficult circumstances. And you know, you mentioned that people are coming to Canada as immigrants. That's been a large part of Canadian history, and people have settled in, say, Western Canada from all over the world, from, you know, Germany, Ukraine, Russia, for different reasons. People have left those countries. Many cases arrived as immigrants. In some cases, when they left their countries, the economic circumstances or perhaps even the conditions in that country with respect to religious freedom and other issues were very difficult. You know, that's contributed to the pretty interesting Canadian mosaic that we've got today that I think all of us appreciate. When you look throughout Saskatchewan or other parts of Canada and you see how rich and diverse our communities are, the idea now that there are particular groups of people that we have concerns with when they arrive and discourage them arriving through a one particular process, I don't think Canadians, generally speaking, want to see this happen.
You know, just to back up one step here, we're on Treaty 4 land.
Right.
We're all immigrants.
Right.
You know, when it comes right down to it, and so it seems kind of ironic to be talking about immigrants when you know, it wasn't our land in the first place.
That's right.
So there you go. And then all of a sudden we have this strange attitude about strangers coming to our land.
Yeah. And as I said earlier in the program, you know, you tie it back to the Woody Guthrie deportee song, and every one of the people who arrives on one of those boats has a name. They're men, women, and children.
Yeah.
They have a name. And to the extent to which I guess people remain nameless is a problem, because you can call them something else, you know. And I don't want to do that. I want to give them a name and give them a welcome in our communities, you know, assuming people are legitimate refugees. And I'm hoping that's something that people will embrace.
Yeah, really, the way the bill is proposed now, you're immediately assuming they've done something wrong. They're subject to immediate detention and doesn't even have to be reviewed for a year.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
You know, I've been sort of reflecting on this a little bit this week, and when people think about the conflicts that exist, and if you just do a little bit of listening and talking to people about the circumstances which they've been in, it can't help but cause one to think, what is going on in this world, where people who are in such desperate situation have to have to flee, and then when they flee, run up against such terrible, terrible barriers to having protection.
Yeah, and this includes children, by the way.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Or, you know, on occasion, even people who are fleeing who have, you know, made a tough choice. You know, I was reading earlier this week in an old Amnesty report, and this story, I just share with you for a second if I can. It actually dates back to 1987, and just prior to the elections in Haiti, there was a situation where a Haitian soldier, and there were terrible, terrible, inhumane acts that were taking place, horrible, horrible human rights violations, atrocities of all kinds, state-sanctioned, by the way, and state-sanctioned murder. A Haitian soldier, his story is just amazing. This dates back to 87. He was stationed at a military camp outside the capital of Haiti in Port-au-Prince. And you know what happened? An army truck arrived carrying a dozen young men. And the prisoners were dragged from the truck, shoved against the wall, and shot in the head. Now this army officer, a Haitian army soldier, who was there at the time, was then ordered to stand guard of the bodies while soldiers went to get the next truck of prisoners. And you know what happened? One of the prisoners who had been shot, was still alive. And he begged this soldier, this Haitian soldier, to cut the rope binding his hands and let him go. The Haitian soldier made the choice to do that. You know, what other choice would you make at that point if you're on your own and had that opportunity? He pointed the prisoner who had, you know, everybody else had been killed. He pointed them, the prisoner, to a path in the jungle, and the prisoner fled. Then the problem was the other soldiers came back and realized, with more prisoners to be executed, by the way, and realized that there was a missing body. They did a count. They realized there was a missing body. And the Haitian soldier who had, you know, freed this person was jailed for 5 months. He was subject to mock executions and beaten and made to confess. And finally, he was, in May 1988, he was discharged. And eventually, he was released and escaped because he knew his life was at risk. He escaped to the Miami in the United States. Can you imagine that, the ordeal that person would have gone through? This is a soldier, by the way, you know, who made a tough choice. And think about that story. So what happens when he arrived in the United States? He was detained for more than 14 months in a camp in Texas, where he was denied access to legal services. And then finally, in July 1990, his application for asylum was rejected. You know,
yeah.
It was rejected. So,
and this is before 9/11.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And eventually, fortunately, I should say, he appealed and his application was finally accepted in May 1993. That's just one little story of hundreds of thousands that, you know, give a person cause to think, what is going on, and and why can't we be more accepting and willing to hear people's stories? You know, the conflict that took place over many, many years in Sri Lanka, you know, was a terrible, terrible conflict. There were things that happened on both sides that were atrocities. They really were. But the idea that then men, women, and children who are fleeing that conflict, risking their lives at sea would not be accepted at our border if they have a story to tell is a problem, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really hard to imagine. It kind of makes me think back to the days of Kennedy when he started the Peace Corps. And I really believe that one of the values of that program is to put young people, students, out into the world to see what the rest of the world is like and give themselves a better understanding of the world around them, and you're less likely to have people who propose or enact provisions like this that are so discriminatory against so many people. I really think that awareness is what's required. Education is what's required. And it seems to be sadly lacking now.
Yeah, and, you know, just to, because I think we're probably getting close to the end of our time.
Oh, we got a little over 4 minutes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the ways you can learn more about Amnesty International's work is going to our website. There's a specific section on the Canadian site, which is at amnesty.ca, that deals with our work relative to amnesty, our refugee issues. Another site that I'd encourage people to explore is the website of the Canadian Council of Refugees, who does excellent work as well. They're easy to find. You know, after you've done a little bit of learning yourself, and perhaps after you've listened to this program, you'll be encouraged to maybe consider approaching your member of parliament. You know, I think there are different perspectives within Parliament about this. I think even some of the members of the government who are proposing this legislation are hesitating about it. It doesn't need to be passed quickly in this form. It could be amended. It could even be withdrawn if Canadians express their concerns about it. So I'm hoping they'll do.
Is your sense that the government's not in a hurry to pass this, as I think they are with Bill C-10?
Well, the minister of who's introduced the legislation said is that they want to see this pass fairly quickly.
Oh.
But it doesn't need to be that way. As I said, there's lots of concerns being raised, and let's reflect on our history, what's good about Canada in terms of some of our traditions, maybe some of the things that were unfortunate in terms of our history, and think about which way we want to go in terms of this particular piece of refugee legislation, and do that in the context of, you know, Canada's international obligations that we've agreed to over the years.
Yeah, some of those obligations seem to have been ignored in this particular legislation, and in some other actions too in Canada's activities in the international community, in the United Nations, and we just seem to be taking backward steps here.
Yeah, and as I say, it doesn't need to be that way. Personally, I think most people I talk to welcoming of individuals who do come to Canada, either as immigrants or refugees. I mean, I go back to an earlier comment I made. I'm so impressed with the numbers of people who are volunteers with an organization like the Regina Open Doors Society or other settlement agencies across the Canada. They're giving of their volunteer time.
Yep.
Generosity. And I hope that people will really kind of reflect on this piece of legislation.
I hope that happens. I hope that happens. I think awareness has an awful lot to do with it. So educate yourself. You know, in these days of the Internet and Google and all the rest of it, it's really not hard to get the facts. Our time's up here now, Gord. So I guess we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim.
Oh, it's been interesting. And we hope the rest of you have enjoyed listening to and learned something new about human rights for all people. For info and For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done."